Hello, I'm Meg Walker and welcome to My Kind of People. Join me as I speak to leaders and community members across the world who all share a passion for positive change. Each week we'll explore the power of community, leadership, passion and positivity and the beauty that can be created when these values come together. Each guest has been a big inspiration to me and I'm grateful to call them my kind of people. I hope they'll be yours too. I'm so excited for us all to connect really soon, but until then, I'm sending big love, good vibes and positive energy. Who are your kind of people? In this episode, I'm delighted to introduce you all to Tracy Radford and Brad English, who both work in co-production with people who have intellectual and developmental disabilities. Together, they have both created One Conversation, an activist movement that uses the simple art of conversation to change people's minds about disability. Throughout this episode, we will get to know more about Tracy and Brad and their incredible work to continue changing the conversation around disability. They both have the biggest hearts and work tirelessly to ensure that every person feels like they are a part of a community. I'm so grateful to have them as part of my community and my kind of people, and I know that they will be your kind of people too. Welcome to the podcast, Tracy Radford and Brad English.
Oh my gosh, what an intro. Oh my God, we can't follow that.
You definitely can. As I said, it is all there in the intro. You are both amazing and thank you so much again, both of you, for coming on to the podcast. And as we are welcoming you to the show, it would be great to give the listeners a little insight as to how we crossed paths. I guess it all started with us meeting first, Tracy. So how did we meet?
We met at a Royal Holloway women's football match where we would come up and we would watch you guys just trying to smash the other team.
You did, and you were a very loyal mum on the side of the pitch in the cold, cheering us all on. And how did you both meet?
We met through a mutual friend called Nick, and we were doing similar, very similar work, but in different guises. And we just got chatting, and the more we chatted, the more we realised that the passions that we both had were the same, and it just sort of grew like that, do you think?
So Nick just saw that we both had very similar outlooks and interests and said, you guys, you should really meet up and talk about the things you were doing. So we did exactly that, didn't we?
Yeah.
And then we started doing some of the same stuff together, and I started coming to some of your events, and there was always a drink after any event we were doing. So, and it would be amongst other people and stuff, but we'd always just end up chatting, and philosophies would be exactly the same. We'd be sort of barking about the same arguments and making the same points. And so it just became quite clear that actually we need to do stuff together. You know? So
amazing. What an awesome pair. Before we learn a little bit more about your work, I would love for the community to learn more about you as people. So where have you both grown and flown? Where were your individual hometowns and where would you consider home now?
Okay, well, I was born in a place called St Albans, which is in Hertfordshire, and I've sort of dotted around little other places, but I came to Nottingham when I was pregnant with my first child. So that has become home. Took a long while for me to call it home. But yeah, that's where I would consider home for now. Nottingham. Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah, that's me.
And so I grew up in Wells in Somerset in the West Country, about a stone's throw from Glastonbury Festival and things.
Nice.
So I grew up, yeah, fields and the cider farms of Somerset. And I also landed in Nottingham via a number of different places. And I've been there for, like 7 or 8 years, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I don't know why I'm going. I have no idea. Yeah.
Can we get that confirmed?
I came to do my master's and just stayed. Yeah. It's a good city.
Amazing. And where on your journeys from Hertfordshire and Somerset to Nottingham did you both develop your passion in getting people to think differently about disability? Have you both always been passionate about this?
Yeah, well, I can't speak, Brad, or I think I can sometimes, but for me, certainly, it was just, even when I was a teenager, I was volunteering at youth clubs for you know, where they were mixing people who had intellectual and developmental disabilities, trying to do that integration stuff. So a long time ago, so I was doing that. And yeah, always, I've always worked with vulnerable communities. So yeah, I think it's just something that's been there. And then I suppose in the last 5-6 years, it's just become really clear how to focus that. So yeah, so it's gone from sort of like need to just sort of work with vulnerable people and give vulnerable people rights to sort of like, no, wait, so much more needs to be done. We've got to really push for this sort of equity of life there for me.
Yeah, I guess it's always been there for me. Also, my older sister has an intellectual disability, Stacey. So I guess disability has always been in our household and in my thoughts and my life. And because Stacey went to the same schools as me, she went to mainstream school, she was always 2 years ahead of me. And I just got to watch her journey through life and then, I guess, be able to make the comparison for my journey through life and school and just seeing where she was getting quite shortchanged and overlooked and different opportunities. And then I was having quite a different experience. So I think it's from there, it's always made it quite apparent to me that there is that disparity. And I think the fields of work I've gone into have always had the opportunity to work with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and I've just always radiated there. So I trained as a primary school teacher and then came back into psychology after having done a degree in psychology and became a clinical psychologist, and always specialised, whether it's teaching or psychology, with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So yeah, it's always been there as something I want to be doing and working with and fighting for. So.
Yeah, it sounds like such a special journey. What has working within the disability community meant to you both personally? Why do you think it is such an important contribution to the world?
I think because it's an overlooked community, I think we have come so far, arguably not far enough, but so far with racial equality and gender equality, but we haven't really, it doesn't really capture society or the general public quite so much. Disability equality, it's just not a thing. So it's so important that we try and catch up. And I think more so this year is the 25th anniversary of the Disability Discrimination Act becoming part of the legal system. And I just think that obviously things have changed, but I think, have they changed enough? I think arguably we would say no. And so we're just carrying that baton for those people that fought really hard, just general people, disabled people that fought really hard to get that Disability Discrimination Act into force. And sort of we're walking in their dreams, you know, dead people's dreams, if you like. We're walking and we have a responsibility to continue doing that work. So, yeah, that's it's so important. So important.
And I think it's just when you see an apparent injustice in front of you, well, for me, it feels quite uncomfortable. And I know it feels the same for Tracy. Mm. And I think by the roots we found into it and the experiences we've had, and particularly me having Stacey in my life, I think knowing how sophisticated and wonderful someone with intellectual and developmental disability often is, and that seeing that overlooked, and also knowing the key to unlocking a little bit of that or accessing that, and it just by treating someone like an adult, like a human adult, and seeing that not being done is something that I feel is a frustration. And when you know, it's like, it's as if you kind of, you've seen the answer, you've seen the way to go about things, and you've learned that, and you see that so many people haven't yet. And you think, well, we've just got to enlighten everyone else to that. We've just got to shift their thinking that little bit, and then that makes this much more cohesive, kind of neurodiverse society where people can appreciate each other for who they are, really, compared to just the label that's slapped on them or some of the difficulties they might have in things that other people don't, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess it's about breaking down those sort of systemic barriers that this community face. You know, there's been all sorts of stuff with physical disability, putting ramps up and this and that and making sort of accessible toilets, et cetera, et cetera. But what actually is happening in terms of advancement in society changing to fit people with intellectual and developmental disabilities? Arguably very little, because you've still got, you know, I think we would say that educationally there's not enough challenge, because where are they going to, do you know what I mean? So you could go to a special school, and then, you know, jobs, you get, what is there? It's, you know, there doesn't seem to be a route, does there, for this community? So they sort of never fit, and that is something that's not addressed. And then they'll go to school, and then they'll be shoved off a cliff edge at, you know, a certain age or a level of educational attainment. And then the future for them is day service, voluntary work if you're lucky, paid job if you're super lucky and you know somebody. But that will be paid work where you're not really part of the team. You're just ticking somebody's sort of demographic requirement or obligation.
And it just becomes a bit of a vicious cycle, doesn't it, with the education thing? Because you've got an education system who doesn't see the need to train people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in that way, because there's no jobs to go to for them, and there's no jobs being provided because they're not coming out with the training. So it just keeps that whole thing going. We see those cycles going and think, well, we're not having that anymore, and we're going to break that a little bit.
Yeah,
and just shine the spotlight on it and say, look, this is where it's going wrong. So either side can do something about it, or how about both sides do something about it? How about we get better training, better education, and then supply the jobs?
Yeah, and I think, and that sort of dovetails us nicely into like the campaign that we're going to be launching at the beginning of next year, which is Are You Satisfied? Because it's not just about people with intellectual and developmental disabilities going, it's not fair, I want this, I want that. It's about everybody looking at that, and the people themselves going, actually, if I want a job, I've got to try harder and this and that. I have a responsibility to bring something to the table. The employer has something to bring back to enable, to make reasonable adjustments, but to understand me. Society generally needs to be dissatisfied with the status quo, if you like. Yes. And that's what we're pushing for. It's not enough. Well, it will get us nowhere if we just go, it's not fair. We have to look at society as a whole and just sort of say, yeah, it isn't fair, but we all have a responsibility. We're all culpable in perpetuating this barrier and prejudice and what have you. So, yeah.
Yes, so beautifully said from both of you. So thank you for that. You have both certainly inspired me with your work and your approach to life and people. Did either of you have anyone that inspired you growing up? And did you have a mentor or maybe anyone in a professional sense that you both looked up to?
Have I had a mentor? I wouldn't say one person at all has inspired me. I think you grab little bits of inspiration from everything that is around you. Certainly, I'm a real wordy person, so I read a lot. John O'Donohue, I really like his words, along with others. But yeah, so no, I don't think there's been anything. People all the time, like, I could look at what you're doing and just think, wow, that's inspirational. I look at what Brad's doing and I think, oh, that's inspirational. So I might take that back. But it is that, you know, and I think everybody, I don't think I could pin it on one person at all. So yeah, just inspiration everywhere is my probably very weak answer.
No, but, I love but it that is there answer.
If you choose to see it.
I think I'd absolutely echo that, because we were having a bit of a chat about this before, about this sort of thing ahead of coming on the podcast. Like, well, yeah, where did you, and saying to each other, was there some like particular person or something that was this thing that sort of changed things for you? And we said similar sort of things. I think I consider myself quite an observant person. I know everyone's a people watcher, but I think I've gone into the professions that I have because I just am fascinated with people and behavior and where all that comes from, and all the sort of the complexities and the intricacies of what makes us who we are and how people operate, and seeing how that interacts with other people and all the dynamics. So I think there's so much to learn from everyone around you, and you learn how to be and how not to be and what works and what doesn't. And you find, I think you make your own models. You make this amalgamation of all these different voices and people and actions that you've seen, and it becomes this kind of like superhero or superhero in your head, where you've just got this kind of entity that you're like, yeah, that's who I'm gonna be. And I think in terms of inspiration and mentorship, I think what we've stumbled into with each other, Tracy and I, in this kind of best friendship collaboration thing, is it's totally mutual mentorship all of the time. Ooh, because we're all each other and trying to take different perspectives and listening to each other. We send each other countless sort of voice notes, just rambling about like thoughts or things we've seen and noticed. So yeah, I think a lot of mentorship and inspiration I get out of my relationship with Tracy, for sure.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think when we're talking about all the people that we are inspired by, I think it's diversity of opinion. I think it's listening to everything and everybody rather than just within an echo chamber that you exist and going, oh, I can only listen to people that agree with me. it's listening to all voices, even if you find them particularly difficult to listen to.
Yes. Relevant right now as well.
Yeah, so relevant right now. We could become such a terribly divided society if we only listen to things that we want to agree with. And I think that that diversity, you know, we're all about diversity, and lots of people would say, oh, we welcome diversity, and that, to a certain extent they do. What people don't welcome is diversity of opinion, and I think that's one of the greatest things that we can have as a human race. So it's all there. Inspiration is everywhere. You just got to listen to everything.
I love that answer from both of you. It's a really beautiful way to look at it, that we can learn and be inspired by everyone. It doesn't have to be one specific person. It can be all of the people we meet along the journey.
And that's part of how we started with the one conversation sentiment as well. When we were trying to figure out a way to make a change, we'd realised with this group, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities we work with, that every single conversation you have changes you. No one goes through any conversation they have, whether that's a heated argument or whether that's a momentary exchange at the checkout in co-op. Every conversation you have changes you in some way. So the premise for us calling it sort of one conversation is that it just takes one conversation to change things and to change your mind. So yeah, every conversation you have is valuable in some way if you're willing to look for it and see it.
So beautifully said. And when did you both create One Conversation, and what do you hope it will contribute to the world?
The idea started to become a reality in 2016. So late 2016 was the idea, and 2017 we did the first event. At the beginning, it was only a thing called One Walk. That's an annual march that takes place in Mansfield in Nottinghamshire. And it is for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and anyone else that supports them to march through the town and sort of stake a claim to, like, we're here, you need to embrace us into society, and just to become visible, because so often they are invisible to most of us. So, and we have a theme each year, so they have placards and what have you, and we just march around. And it's really good. And in 2019, we had over 900 people march. So that's that was pretty impressive. So yeah. But One Conversation came about as a result of that march, because we were doing the march and people were going, oh, this is amazing, it's changing, it's this, I've really changed my mind. But the reality of that change is it was probably maybe a day, maybe a week, it changed people's opinions, but it didn't really do much after that, did it?
No, so you've got the rest of the year to contend with. And if you have a disability, treated differently by society and get hassled on the bus and like huffed at in Sainsbury's, or much worse. I mean, they're quite tame examples, but we have guys that suffer sort of horrible abuse in the streets and things. So yeah, so but for that day, for that week, it was great and things were changing. But the guys we were working with were all just sort of saying, we want to be like One Walk every week, we want it to happen all year round. So we said, right, well, we can't have a march every week, how do we make sustainable change happen? That's where it all started.
Yeah.
Discussions about that with them, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I think it very quickly became apparent that, you know, you can shout up to people in power all you like, but actually you want change, you have to do something about it. And so we started from the grassroots. What can you do as a group of activists? Where's your superpower?
And where do you see biggest change happening? Was the other thing we asked them. We were saying, so you've spoke on the stage at One Walk and you've done this and you've given presentations and stuff, but where do you see the biggest changes happening? Where do you really notice someone think differently? And they said, when we get to talk to them face to face. And that was it. That was the kind of eureka moment. They're like, that's what we've got to do. We don't shout from stages or go on the media or on the news. We go right down to bottom up approach and we talk to individuals. And so we then spent a good 6 months to a year working with a group of people who wanted to be involved in this activist movement. We've never called it a project because we feel like a project has an end, and this is not going to end. This will keep
going. Can't end.
Yeah. So called it an activist movement, and we were figuring out the ways to make this happen. We worked hard with them on how to have a conversation with people, because there is an art to that, as an art to listening and not interrupting and being interesting. Even there were certain times when we were having sessions with the guys about like the distinction between what's an interesting conversation and what's quite a boring conversation, because if you're just talking about what you had for tea all the time, people are going to lose interest.
And I think also one of the things we learned really early on was that because a lot of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are either seen as victims or heroes, and heroes for doing the slightest thing, you know, and it's just like, that's just ridiculous. Yeah, everyone's just a human. So it was really important, we all felt, that they didn't do the sort of hooba hooba, it's not fair, poor old disabled me, you know, and because that gets you nowhere, and that, well, that just perpetuates the sort of poor old person. What they talk about, if they talk about their disability, which they're very happy to do, they talk about it with a strength. They talk about relationships, sex, things, the same things that you and I would talk about. Yeah, all of that. And that's, I think you can change someone's opinion by just having a regular conversation without ramming anything down somebody's throat, because they'll walk away and just go, blimey, I've just talked about politics or this or that, or discovered new things. And I think that's quite an important no victim narrative.
Yeah. You know? So we vowed to shed the victimhood narrative in that way, and then just decided we had to figure out ways that we could go and have these conversations. The next sort of development of it was, right, we know how to have conversations. We know we want to have conversations. Why aren't these conversations happening? People aren't approaching us, so we have to go and approach them. So that was the next step, is to figure out how we find ways to take this conversation to the right sort of people. So the key targets early on were schools. We thought it was really important to go into young people because that's where minds are being molded.
Yeah.
So it's a key time when people are making their mind up about things to give mm-hmm. them these experiences, so that they, you know, have all the information to make an informed decision about disabilities, as opposed to just being sort of fed narratives by parents or the separation you see through special schools and mainstream schools. So you just making all those kind of schemas about disability that way. We said, well, get in there early and show that you can have this conversation with someone with a learning disability or autism, and they'll see it differently and they'll remember that person. So we went for that. It was schools, it was businesses we thought we'd go to.
Yeah.
We've worked with football club and spoke to the football players. And then we thought taking it out into the town, the community need to hear this. So we had pre-lockdown and pre-COVID stuff. We had a monthly residency in a bar in Mansfield as well, called Cafe Lounge. Big shout out to Cafe Lounge.
Yeah, shout out to Cafe Lounge.
Massive advocates, Jess in particular. But they took us in. We went and spoke to them and said that we want to do one conversation sessions once a month in here, where we just hear and present so people can have these conversations. And they just totally embraced it. So they allowed us, well, the guys, the activists who all have intellectual and developmental disabilities, they allowed them to train the staff on disabilities and on one conversation and how it works. And then once a month, we'd occupy the bar, completely transform it.
Yeah, it was a real one conversation takeover. It was just, we were just there, and we'd decorate it and we'd change it and we'd do, and we were just there. And then, you know, the punters would come in and we would just chat
and
to them.
The guys would, it would just be this intermingling of people with IDD and neurotypicals who were just coming in. And it got called in the end Tapas and Talk, because it was a tapas in Capo Lounge. Wonderfully supportive of them. They said, okay, well, people who are having conversations, we'll bring over free plates of tapas. So
you'd just really
be sharing
cool.
plates of tapas, having a beer and having a chat to someone with any sort of disability.
And just seeing sort of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities out in the evening, having a beer, oh my gosh, and talking to a neurotypical person. Wow, you know, what is this place? So I think it's that, really. I think it was just, even if you didn't take part in the conversation, your prejudices were sort of shifted a little bit.
Because you're bearing witness to something that you're not familiar with and you're curious about it. And that's how a lot of the people got involved as well. They'd be curious about what was happening and they'd see, and we'd make it all bells and whistles and stuff. They had a few conversation games. They had like a bell and a horn, and they got quite rowdy, but that, as a result, people were like, what is that over there? Can I chat to them?
Yeah, it's nice. So we're, you know, pre-COVID, as Brad was saying, we were all over. And now we're digital. So we're doing digital, like pen pally things with schools. It's quite difficult with businesses and what have you. But the schools thing's working quite beautifully,
Cool, because we're doing it, as Tracy says, kind of like digital message in a bottle kind of thing, that this thing keeps bouncing back between the schools, where we send a video that we shoot and create and then intersperse. We make it quite punky and edgy, and it has a lot of like archive footage and found footage mixed in with it, so it becomes this like piece of art that lands at the school.
Amazing.
And this group of year 8s get to watch it, and then they reel off these questions and these messages that come back to us.
Yeah.
And then we record another video to them from the guys. And it's just, again, shifting these people's thoughts and understanding of how cool people with intellectual development
is. Totally. And the aim, really, with all the sort of stuff that we're doing is that people become sort of like horizontal influencers. So they will just, they will talk to somebody else. They will go, you know, and so a lot of young people, there's a lot of sort of, you don't know who you are when you're growing up and things like that. So a lot of bullying that can occur because you're just part of the pack. So the idea would be, you know, certainly with young people, that they were in a crowd after having a one conversation, if they were in a crowd of their mates and somebody was shouting whatever at somebody with an intellectual developmental disability, they might go, mate, don't do that. Don't do that, because I've spoken to somebody. And, you know, that little, it's much, that horizontal influence is so much more powerful than coming down from a teacher or a parent or whatever. So that's the hope, that this will just sort of ripple out, really, and just become, you know, you talk to 20 people, they will then talk to whatever, and so on and so forth. So,
yeah, it's so important. And we all do have our own part to play. I'm so glad you brought up the misconceptions that there are around people with disabilities. I completely agree with so many of the points you said. I actually used to be a job coach for young adults with learning disabilities. And so, so often, the biggest barrier I'd come up against when finding job opportunities for the students I worked with was fear. I think so many employers were scared of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing. And that fear often just came from the unknown. And 99% of the time, all of this fear was removed pretty much instantly from them just having a 5-minute conversation with a student by getting to know them as a person and taking the time to ask each other questions so that they can better understand one another. I think every time that we are willing to have a conversation with someone new, especially with someone we feel may be different to us, you find that you have more similarities than you have differences. And it's something I feel very passionate about. And I genuinely believe that every person has value to bring to the world and that everyone can be an asset to our communities. But we have to be made to feel welcome and we have to be given an opportunity to do that. So I think the work you are doing is so incredibly important. And I think there are still so many conversations to be had.
Oh, yeah. You know, everybody needs to have one conversation. Obviously, we're going to say that because we created it. But
it's a good line. It's
but
good
it
line.
It's really important because it's just like, that's how we change things, and change needs to occur. Can't sit around and expect somebody else to do it. It's got to, we've all got to take part and want to do that. Who doesn't want a better world, you know? That's what we've got to do, talk to each other.
Yeah, and how would you like to see the conversation around disability improve further?
Oh, I think it's about, ideally, I'd like politicians and policymakers to just go, you know, we're getting this wrong. You know, it's, who is this serving? Because we're putting people in the woods in institutions or schools in the woods or day services in the woods. They're just, you know, we had the sort of, we took people out of institutions and put them in the community, but there was no community for them to be parachuted into. So it's sort of like things have been done, but it's not really been joined up. So I think it's about saying, okay, if we are going to try and make it more of an equal society, so people with intellectual and developmental disabilities can have jobs, relationships, et cetera, like you and I will have, then we need to look at how we make that happen. And how we make that happen is how we make that happen for everybody else. Challenge, hard work, you know, wanting this for somebody. It's as simple as that. Things are not always going to be available to everyone. Things aren't always available to, you know, you and I, you'll be able to do things I can't, and vice versa. So, you know, that's just the way of the world. But we have to want to give this community opportunity and chance and challenge and think better of each other.
Yeah, and I think one thing for us as well is that you don't see enough respect for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in terms of being honest with them. Yes. And I think there's far too much of people, again, it's like you said, Meg, with the idea of the fear being a big part of it, but there's such a lot of respect you have to have for someone to be able to be honest and say, that idea you just had doesn't make any sense.
It's rubbish. Yeah.
That that really drawing you've done doesn't really resemble what you said, but we can look at ways to help that change. And I think that's where we found so much traction with the activists we work with, is we operate with brutal honesty because we respect them so much. And if they say something that is rude or incorrect or ill thought out, then they will know about it because we respect them enough to tell them, and vice versa. And they call us out on our stuff. And we have this culture of like calling each other out on stuff. But and this is what gets missed, isn't it? And I think there's
completely
it's all a kind of sort of a reverberation of the idea of people with IDD being like this perpetual child and just being treated, because society and particularly people who haven't had experiences of people with disabilities don't really know what to do with it. They kind of slot it in alongside their concepts of children. And I think that in turn is all a bit of a hangover from the concept of the mental age, and like a concept that we should not be using anymore. You don't equate someone to having a mental age of a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old, because it doesn't make any sense, because your brain is modular and multifaceted.
It's not a blanket term, yeah.
Exactly. So that's not how we work cognitively. But because those narratives are out there and there's this idea of this perpetual child and this mental age, then people get kind of treated a lot like children, and then they're kind of tiptoed around and not given the respect enough to be allowed to be
humans with agency,
human and resilient humans with agency, and sophisticated individuals that can have thoughts and emotions that are complex.
Yeah, it is. I think that whole perpetual child, so that then if you are lucky enough to get in front of an employer right now, then you will present in a way that is childish, perhaps, or this, you know, so we're just all doing each other a disservice with it all. And so that's sort of what's got to change, that to not be frightened to treat people with IDD the same as you would any other human, with kindness and love and respect. You know, I don't treat you like a child, you know, not always. So, you know, it's that sort of thing. And you wouldn't dream of doing it with anybody else. You wouldn't dream of going, oh, it's amazing what you've done, even if it's rubbish.
It's another, you know, it's another example of, I think we think a lot in our work in terms of the cycles that need to be broken. And that is just yet another one. It's that thing of treating someone with a lack of respect, of not giving them the opportunity to grow and be. And then for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, becoming that, like it becoming a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then they, as you say, acting in accordance with that, because they're told a lot about themselves by the way they're treated, and as a result that's part of what their identity becomes themselves. That's why so many find themselves so confused about who they are and what they are and what they should be and can be.
And if any of us were told whatever we do is brilliant or amazing, you would have no gauge on what, you know, you just sort of think, you know, you wouldn't be able to operate. And I think it's that, you stop the hero victim thing. And it's just like, it's just, life is beautiful. It's that, it's the same for everybody. And we just need to adjust that so it accommodates everybody. And that's going to need some sort of reasonable adjustment, but it doesn't mean that it's a negative thing, you know?
For sure. And you said it so well. And I think you're right. We need to be seeing people as people before we see their disability. That's the biggest thing. See them and see them as people, just like we would with anyone else before we see the disability. It's something I discuss with employers a lot. I have one example with an employer where he was working with two autistic students, and I came in one day and he was like, Meg, I know they are both autistic, but they are so different. This student loves doing this task and this student hates doing this task. And I said, well, yeah, because they are completely different people. Myself and you, we don't like the same things. And he had to take a step back and think. And he was like, yeah, you're completely right. Yeah, of course. And he wasn't meaning anything bad by it. He was just genuinely not seeing the bigger picture. He was so focused on trying to do right by their disability and to see their disability that he wasn't actually seeing them as people first. And of course they are going to have different likes and dislikes. Autism in itself is a spectrum.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? And we all carry those unconscious biases about how we should do things and how, you know, we box people all the time, which is the most dangerous thing I think you can do.
And then if you layer on top of that, we work with some people with Down syndrome and the sort of physical similarities there with it not being a hidden disability just adds that extra layer of presumption, doesn't
yeah.
it, as to how similar people are going to be and how similar their outlook is and what they understand and even their cognitive ability, like, because there's such a range in that physical ability. Even I can't remember what's the lad's name in Florida who's just done the Ironman.
Chris
Man.
Nickett.
Oh man, yeah,
Chris Nickett.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
amazing. 1% better every day.
Yeah. This community can have an absolutely equitable place within the world, given the drive. He's had to work hard. He wouldn't have been able to do that if he just sat around and nope. what have you.
But, and the trainer, like, I was watching videos of him and the trainers he's worked with as well, and they were putting him through a grueling process.
Quite right.
Because they respected 100%. Him yeah. enough to do so. And what happens? Look at
yeah.
him.
Yeah, I know. It just makes history. And that's what's got to happen. Don't be frightened. Let's stop being frightened. It's all about hard work, isn't it? You know, that's where
Absolutely.
You get where you're going to get.
Absolutely. And that was his whole campaign, getting 1% better every day. His parents get him to write his goals down every year, just like anyone else with the new year. And I think he wanted a wife and a car, so great ambitions there. A hot wife, I think he said. It was very specific. But he also wanted to do an Ironman, and everyone around him was like, right, well, you're going to have to put in the work. So his whole campaign was that he was going to get 1% better every day. And that's what he did. Every day he put the work in, and now he's officially an Ironman, which is incredible.
Yeah. And what's lovely about that is his support network believed that he could get 1% better every day.
Absolutely.
And that's the key, isn't it? Someone going, oh, don't, yeah, all right. I don't think you can, but all right. You know, it's actually, we will force you. If this is your goal, let's all fight for this.
And I think one of the big things that comes down to, and something that we've said from the very start with our work, is about expectation and what we expect of and from this population. That's the major difference. Everything, you can boil everything we do down to that.
Yeah, that's so true.
And it's about what we expect of and from them in terms of what they are capable of, but what we expect them to put in as well, and how we expect them to contribute to their growth. So yeah, expectations is massive, and expectations were changed for him and stuff gets expanded. But if your expectations are really tiny and really small, you're not going to be going anywhere, are you?
Yeah.
It holds people down for sure. So
yeah,
expectations are really
that's so true. Expectations, because it's your self expectation. You're going to get nothing unless you work hard.
Yeah.
But expect more from others. Expect, you know, don't just take the first partner that comes along. Expect to get the partner that you want. Expect this. It's that, isn't it? And that's how you move forward successfully in life, by just going, no, I think more, or actually we can do. Yeah, it's that.
Yeah, and have those discussions. Let people know what you want. So many times with employers, I'd say, speak to them. You know, you're speaking to me, but talk to them. Have a conversation. What do you want? How are you going to achieve this together? If you are finding that they are not quite hitting the mark, then have that conversation with them. Find out what they are finding difficult, or why do they enjoy that task so much? Have a conversation on both ends.
Yes. And by having that conversation, that you're sort of expecting more from them as an employee, and you're expecting, you know, and they will just think, oh, okay, well, I've got to step up. And then that whole thing becomes sort of understandable then. It's just like, okay, well, I'll do this and that. But, you know, just because that's how the world works. Everybody has supervision or appraisals or this or that. And that's what you've just got to afford everybody else and not be frightened to do that. Place that expectation on people.
But that can be totally blocked if you expect there's going to be no point in doing that.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Expectation could be very small.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. Yeah.
But you would think that if you don't have those conversations, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And I think shifting expectations is just massive. And that's why we try and do a lot of that with one conversation. The activists will be sometimes now lecturing at universities with me with some of my lecturing and stuff.
So
and just,
cool.
You know, that all the people then who sat there as students being lectured by someone with a learning disability or with autism, is walking out of that room with a different expectation for that population. And they will now be people who have received a lecture from someone with an IDD. So it just their expectations shift that little bit. And if you can start to nudge people's expectations in that way, it doesn't need to be a massive shift. That's part of what the campaign we're doing is at the moment, isn't it? They're not satisfied. And we're talking about jobs, and we've got this campaign, like a media promotional campaign coming up, where we're looking at using a concept of talking about jobs and someone saying, I don't want to be a surgeon or a pilot. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I just want a job. And and so just don't just discount it because you're thinking, oh, I'm not capable of any job. See the nuance. Like I'm saying, I guess you don't need massive shifts in your expectations and your understanding. It just takes this little nudge. You just need to be shifted along a little bit to see the light.
And thinking is seriously underrated. So I think, it's just thinking differently. Getting rid of that unconscious bias and thinking and being inspired, coming back right back to what we said at the beginning about inspired by people that you meet. And it's all of that, isn't it? And just being open to stuff. We're way too closed.
Yeah. And I think the similarities we all have as humans is the desire to feel seen and heard and valued and ultimately feel like part of a community. How would you personally define the word community, and what has leading and being part of one meant to you both?
Gosh, okay, community. I think, it always sounds a little bit like I'm giving some sort of manifesto speech. But, I think community, you have to think small and you have to think big. So obviously we're part of the global community, and then we're all trying to make that be good and be better. We have a responsibility to that wider community and whatever we can do that way. But your community, I think for me, it's a movable beast. It's not a thing. It's not a set structure. I would say everything is the community wherever I am at any point that I am at. So now, right now, us three, that's the community. You go somewhere else, that's your community. And I think that you have to see, even if you're in a shop, and you don't know anybody that's in that shop, you just think, okay, this is my community now, right now. I'm on an aeroplane. This is my community right now. And it's that. And you just behave with that community as you would if it was a community that you were particularly fond of.
That's such a beautiful way to look at it. I love that.
Yeah, I agree.
My work is done.
I think for me, in terms of community, sort of concepts of reciprocity and contribution are very central to making any form of group, which you're going to define as a community, sort of cohesive. And I think that's the essential part of enabling people with IDD to be cohesively part of any community. You take the steps back to looking at these concepts of reciprocity and contribution, and for all too long it's been presumed that people with IDD can't contribute to society. They take from society, they take benefits, so they take care, but they're not offering this reciprocity. But my argument would be because they're not being given the opportunity to contribute. And as soon as we give them the openings and the opportunity to contribute and the respect to be sort of supported to contribute in the right ways and sort of challenged to do so and to rise to that, we see time and time again with the guys that we work with, they then become contributors. Reciprocity is then there, and then everyone is feeding into this community and this whole, and then you can be a part of it. And it's not only the value for the community, so they're not being shortchanged or being kind of having something taken out by certain individuals and not put back in, and the stigma that comes with that, but the value that comes with being able to be a contributor should never be overlooked. And that's something that's been denied of this population for so long. And early concepts of things like social role valorization have really kind of been key to what we're doing, and looking at how it's so important to have a purpose and to have a responsibility and to be
part
to be part of it. And given that, life changes for you, and that's such an integral part to someone being all they can be and reaching their potential and being allowed to just be everything they
be part of it rather than just a bystander.
Exactly.
That's how
such value in that for all sorts as well, for mental health and what it does for someone and quality of life. Let's all muck in and be part of it, because it feels good, right?
It really does. And That's what we all want. We all want to feel part of a community and to feel valued. And very well said, we want to feel part of it and not a bystander. What have the members of your One Conversation community taught you? What do you think makes them so special?
What have they taught
us? Crikey, what have they taught us? That we have a lot of work to do. we say that sort of jokingly, but it's a sort of like, because we are breaking these sort of stereotypes that they've started to live up to with the sort of the eternal child and the this or the that. And so they've made us realize that, crikey, we really need to get to people and start changing them and getting them to feel this, not just having conversations with others. We've got to change the actual community that we're working with before they can go out and do all of that. So there's a lot of work there to do. But I think they've taught us, for me, I just think it's like, this is going to work. This is how we're going to change things, because it's, you know, it feels exactly the right thing to do because it's them and they're talking. And exactly like 25 years ago, when the everyday person was campaigning for disability equality and the subsequent DDA legislation, you know, these are just your everyday people who can really change things. And I think that's what it's teaching us, isn't it? It's like, oh my gosh. This
yeah, I think thing. It is confirmation that given the opportunity, people will grow and expand beyond what the expectations there have been put
be
on them.
Asset.
And that's what each and every one of our guys is doing. And it's just that lovely sense of confirmation of what we had an inkling of and what we were starting to see in the people we were working with in perhaps more formal and professional manners, because we do refer to the One Conversation group, we all refer to ourselves as a bit of a family, and that's something that's happened from very early on. And they are very keen to always draw people's attention to the fact that this activist movement is a family, and we do things together, and we go out for meals and we go out for drinks, and it is really enjoyable. And I think that's some of that confirmation as well, that
it's just doable. It's achievable. You know, if we can do it with a group of activists, we can scale up and do it across everywhere.
Definitely. Do you have any standout moments that you are particularly proud of, either from your current work or your previous work?
I think we'd say we're very proud of it.
I think it's a proud moment for me when I take some of the activists to other stuff I'm doing. So like when I lecture at universities on like postgraduate and doctorate kind of courses, and I'll invite a couple of guys because I'll be teaching on something to do with learning disabilities and autism. Mm. They'll come and take some of the session. And I just love that we rock up and we have this bond that's apparent to all when we're teaching and stuff. And you can see this. And those moments for me, when you can see the sort of like the cock of the head and the like the sort of glimmer in the eye of those watching you being like, oh, it can be different, can't it? You can just get along and work really cohesively and work nicely. So those moments for me, and I've taken them into, I work 3 days a week in the NHS as well as a clinical psychologist. And I've done One Conversation sessions to my departments before when I've worked in different places, and they've taken the psychologist to task and really challenged them, haven't they?
Yeah.
With different questions and things. And so yeah, there's moments for me. The other moment that just sticks in my head is when we were doing the conversation cafe, and we were on our lunch break, all of us as a group of activists, and we often talk about kind of sex and relationships and stuff. They're very open and candid, but this conversation just started about sexual orientation and sexual preferences, and it just went round as we were all eating our lunch about different people were sort of opening up about like identifying as bi and different experiences they have. And one guy was like, I had a boyfriend for a while before my last girlfriend. I'm like, wait, what? And then and it was so open, one of the activists came out at that lunch
I love that.
And it was just so, I don't know, it just felt so safe and warm but fun and funny, and just knowing that so many people I see in my other line of work with the psychology side of things and having to work with people therapeutically are so bound over their sexual expression, let alone their orientation and sexual identity and things, and knowing how it's so often unspoken and it's not a thing to be thought about, because people don't think that people with IDD
can or should.
Yeah, have sex or have a relationship. So just to be in this environment where it's this natural flowing conversation where everyone's safe enough and someone's safe enough to come out
amazing
there and then.
You do feel as though you're stepping forwards with it all, and it's just the stepping forward is just like regular conversations that we'd all have with everyone else, but it's with this community, and it's just like, oh yes, here we go, this is becoming regular and mainstream, and this is how it should be. And having that sort of flex to be able to do that without going, oh, we're going to talk about sex, oh my gosh, should we? Yes, we should. Yes.
Consent form.
Yes. Is this risky? Should we do this? Oh my gosh, they said something, you know. It's just like, just great. So it's that, it is those moments. And I think also getting other people to just go, those little light bulb moments, I think are always such a joy to watch when you see someone and you know that their mind has changed, or, you know, and they'll walk away and they will never be the same again. So it's those things, isn't it? It's that, you know, and it's catching on.
I love it. You were talking earlier about connecting with your community. And because of COVID at the moment, you've said it's currently more online. How do you hope to continue to develop those platforms? Do you hope to have a half online presence, half in person?
I think what's been good, I mean, you know, I'm not enjoying any of this process of lockdown and pandemic, but what has come out of this is that doing the school's work, particularly from a digital platform, it's enabled us to reach geographically so much further. Be that bringing in new activists who don't live locally, so we can engage them and then they can get involved in the movement. And also we could go to the other side of the world if somebody came to us and said, you fancy doing that one conversation? We wouldn't have done that, would we, at all, had it not been for this pandemic. So, you know, silver linings and all that sort of stuff. But I think what we would particularly like to do is to be just going out and doing more and having more and show it. Just conversations with everybody, would you say?
Yeah. We'll get out there face to face as much as possible as soon as anything opens up into doing it.
Yeah. But
we're just making sure we utilize what we've got with the opportunities online as well. One thing we will take through with us as well, as we started, as soon as lockdown kicked in, that first one in March, we were realizing we do a couple of one conversation sessions which went solely online, so the workshops. And people were just getting so kind of, I don't know, as the weeks went on, they're getting really drained, weren't they? And losing the art of conversation. It's harder on Zoom and things. So in order just to get us up to speed with conversing again, we started a film club, which we branched out to anyone with IDD who wants to come. So each week we select a film. Generally, it's free to watch on like iPlayer or All 4 or something. Watch it, and then on a Thursday morning, we meet and dissect the film.
Yeah,
and it's been
great,
fantastic. We'll keep that going after we're all
that's
out.
That's very true.
It's just been such a, and it's all films, like it's had a real edgy film program. It's anything from documentaries to horror comedy. Like we had old Hitchcock films. And
brilliant.
Just stuff they would
more indie films
watch.
And stuff. Yeah. So that's been really good. And I guess what do we want to do going forwards? I think it's we're planning a big festival next year. Instead of just the walk, we're going to have a whole week of celebrating diversity. And so, and we've joined up forces with a production company called Ingenious Fools. And so they're bringing a comedy, disability comedy festival as well. So that's what we're doing. But I think from a sort of scale up point of view, when we launch the campaign, it's to start that thinking process. So we can do what we can with conversations locally and we can take them wherever. But I think if we can get some sort of traction on the hashtag Are You Satisfied campaign and start those conversations with people of influence and policymakers, all of that sort of stuff, or even just parents of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities going, do you know what? I'm not satisfied. And I think I need to start speaking. And I think I need to start expecting or demanding more. Or teachers going, you know, I don't want to diss anything, but I think we could be challenging. You know, that they're the conversations that we want to try and initiate through this campaign. Because if we're going to really make an impact, we do need to scale up. And so hopefully that, and ideally, we'd get some wonderful philanthropic person and would go, and we're going to back you to do this.
Yeah, let's put out those good vibes. Thank you very much for that. I think there really is so much good in the world to be found. And like you said earlier, especially within our own local communities. What do you think is the importance of inspiring positive change within our local and then wider communities?
Because I think it breeds positivity. I think if you can inspire people, I think then they feel that they have the power to change something as well. I think it's that. So I think if you can, or one of our activists or us, or, you know, can inspire somebody to think differently or whatever, then it will just snowball out. It'll domino, and that's what will happen. So I think that's, for us, I think that's what's important about inspiring a community. And we should always be looking for change, actually. We should always be looking. We should never sit back and go, you know, our work here is done. It's lovely. We should be striving always.
Yeah, and I think it's honouring life doing that, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, for sure.
It's about where you kind of, I don't know, where you direct societies or locally everyone's attention, I suppose, isn't it? And it's kind of makes me think of like a plant growing towards the light. That's the way we all want to go. Mm. We want to go in a positive direction. We want to follow the thing that gives us life, and we can't always quite find it. So sometimes it takes certain groups or certain voices or certain individuals to just give that little nudge or direction to say that the light's over here, let's all grow in that way. And I think everyone's inclined to grow that way anyway, given the right sort of opportunity. Again, the word opportunity.
But I think we can all be the light. Yeah. I think, you know, if we are all respectful and kind, I'm not saying I'm like the sun and you can all orbit me, but I think it's that sort of like, if we are the light, if we see what could be better or whatever, then we then become the light and people will gravitate towards us. We can change things. So, yeah, I think it is that. It is. Yeah, we all have a responsibility.
Yes. Be the light. And so articulately put. I think it's such a good point, because we can look at the world and there may be so many things that we want to change and it can be overwhelming, but we often overlook our own communities, and that's often where the change needs to start. It's actually a reason why I wanted to do the podcast. It's to show people, just look around the people they know. There is so much positivity and there are so many people trying to make positive change. If we look at the world as a whole, it can seem so overwhelming. You think, where can I even start? How can I change the whole world? Well, usually the starting place for that is in ourselves and in our close network of people and what they are doing. I think you don't really have to look very far often to find these amazing people. Even at the side of a football pitch, doing wonderful
things—that's so lovely. Thank you. That's amazing. That's so amazing.
It's very true, and I've experienced that when starting and championing any movement, it can require a lot of energy and a lot of patience. As wonderful as positive change is, it definitely takes time. How do you try to keep your positive energy, and what motivates you?
Oh my gosh. I know this is going to sound like super cheesy, but I'm always just so happy to be alive. Seriously, that's the point. You know, you are here for a reason. Every human is here for a reason. And you need to keep looking until you find that reason or that campaign or whatever you want to do with your life. But you have a point of being in here, on here. So yeah, it's just that. And that's what keeps, certainly for me, I have a part to play. I have a role, I have a duty to do something.
Yeah, and I think it's just making sure that you take the time to stop and look around and see, because there's always something around you to see and absorb. And whether that's the way the clouds are in the sky at the moment, whether it's just a piece of music that's come on your iPad or iPod, or just sit and just open yourself every so often. There's something really kind of therapeutic and cathartic about that, or taking a walk. And I know it doesn't relate directly, I suppose, but that for me is what can be quite rejuvenating and gives you that influx of energy to be like, okay, yeah. And you just get then your own kind of ideas and feelings about the significance or insignificance of you and us and everything we're doing. And so, yeah, so I think that's really important. And just also knowing when to blow off steam and have a beer, and knowing when to stop with that as well.
Yeah.
I think sometimes you just say, like, today's not working.
Yeah.
Let's grab a beer and let's just chat about nonsense.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to flog the dead horse of completing this funding bid or something that's not happening. And that feels good as well, doesn't it? When you're like, because I always feel as well when we do that, and it's like you come at it the next day or whenever, you're like,
yeah,
I could have
so much better. Yeah,
last night,
yeah.
And now we're here, and now this is better.
Yeah, and it's find the joy. I think, you know, there is so much joy to be had. Just, I know that will elicit a lot of possible eye rolls, people listening.
No,
but it's just like, it's so true. You know, it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. Got a little baby at home. He's just had a baby.
Oh, congratulations. And she's called Joy. Oh, yes. Ah, you both are the best. You have absolute sunshine souls, and the work you are doing is life-changing. And I'm eager for more lives to be changed for the better through your work. So how can people experience your work? Where can they reach you?
The best place to start would be to look at us on social media, see a little bit about what we're doing. You get a bit of a kind of blurb of who we are. Our website is oneconversation.co.uk, so that gives you more of an insight of what we're doing. That gives the opportunities to kind of get involved, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I would say, really, other than looking out on those channels for things like OneFest that will be happening next year, our email address and phone numbers are on all of what we do. Just reach out to us. We get back people. We love hearing from people. And like we say, it just takes one conversation to sort of change people's minds and change people's lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're looking for those conversations. So drop us a line if you've got anything to say or want to be involved or
just want to join the campaign or the community. Yeah. Let's just do that.
Yeah. We're quite approachable.
Yeah.
I think so. I'd agree. I'd definitely agree with that. And it's so great to hear that you've got so many amazing projects and upcoming events in the pipeline as well. I know you both have shared so much wisdom throughout this episode, but before we finish the podcast, I would love if you could share any words of advice that you have particularly been inspired by over the years.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so I think the moment, I think for me, that I really recall is I was working at a secondary school in Retford, and the head teacher said to me, he said, "You're a catalyst." He said, "Don't underestimate that." And that moment, something lit up inside of me, and I just thought, oh yeah, that's my little superpower. I can change. I can do that. I can bring about change. And I don't sort of dine out on that at all, but I just hold that in the sort of like, that's what I am capable of. I don't know. He just identified part of me that is so important to me. And I was just doing, and that moment was just sort of like, oh my gosh. Yeah, that's what I do.
I've got goosebumps. That's lovely.
I think mine is kind of a product of a lot of the kind of psychotherapy that I have sort of delivered. It's a wonderful job. You work with loads of different people, with loads of different mindsets, and you get to know so much about people's lives. But I think one thing that's come out of that for me is the importance of the distinction between the ideas of you get what you give and you reap what you sow, and living kind of by the former, that you get what you give, and feeling hard done by when people aren't doing as much for you as you're doing for the world is not a great way to live, and you're not going to find just sort of happiness or fulfillment through that. But making the slight switch to you reap what you sow, and having a proactive kind of role in what comes back to you and sowing those seeds, I think, is just so important. And you need to do something if you want change to happen. So you can't just sit and wait for change to happen to you. So yeah, that's kind of a combination of and a tribute to all the kind of patients I've had over the years, because they've given me that kind of concept to share.
Be the change you wish to see. Absolutely.
Indeed.
Oh, Tracy and Brad, this conversation today has made my soul so happy. So thank you so much. Thank you for all of the work you are doing in the world. Thank you for encouraging us all to start and to continue to have important conversations and to always remain open to welcoming others. Thank you for reminding us that we are more similar than we are different. And thank you for being my kind of people.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
You are very welcome. Keep shining, my sunshine souls. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of My Kind of People. I hope you felt the positive energy from this week's guest. If this episode was of value to you, then please rate, review, and subscribe. It's so greatly appreciated. Thanks again.